You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm not.
Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bowed. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538 Sports Podcast. I'm Chad Matlin, an editor at 538. With me in the studio, the full crew is back. Kate Fagan, ESPNW columnist. Kate, so wonderful to see ya.
Hi, Chad.
How did the book go? Did you guys already
talk
about that last week?
Oh, we did talk about it, but okay. I will talk about it again if you want to.
Because you're so happy it's done?
Yeah, it's amazing. With my editor.
Amazing.
So I am no longer in charge of the next step with it.
Right.
And she can take as long as she wants. Well, no longer than like 8 months, but if she wants to take a month to get me edits, that's fine.
Because you're just kicking back.
Yeah.
That's excellent.
It's a good feeling.
Neil Payne.
It is.
Hey, Chad.
538 Sports writer. Hello, Neil. How is your book coming?
My book is going very well.
Yeah. Still in the early stages and show it.
Right, exactly. We're just kind of doing pitch meetings.
It's about Tim Tebow's baseball
shopping
career,
it?
Right?
Yeah, I'm shopping it around. It is about Tim Tebow's future in the sport of baseball. And Gary Sheffield, I've heard, is going to teach him everything he needs to know, which will presumably include playing horrible defense and using performance-enhancing drugs. So he should be set, I feel like, after meeting with Chef.
The Tebow kneel after he scored at home plate instead of a touchdown would be incredible if he pulled it off on the
left.
What was that called? Tebowing?
It was called Tebowing,
I was confused when you said the Tebow kneel because I thought you were talking to Neil Payne.
Yeah. I was like.
But it was the K-N-E-E-L.
Right.
You see?
Yes. And now we're going to cut to Neil Greenberg. the other Neil. No.
Not this week.
Not
no this hockey.
Week.
Instead, we have Olympics. It is an Olympics palooza. Allison McCann is going to report from the field in Rio. She's there. I think she's somewhere in the gymnastics.
Attempting to get into the
gymnasium.
Gymnastics.
Yeah, hoping to see Simone Biles lead the way for the Team USA.
Oh, is it literally called a gymnasium?
That's what a
It's probably an arena.
An arena?
I mean, because this is a big deal and they want to pack people in. So it's
but
probably
it should
not a
be,
gymnasium.
Right, but it should be called that because they're performing gymnastics there.
True.
I'm not familiar with gymnastics parlance, excuse me. Then we'll go to the pool where world records are falling left and right. We'll discuss which records have been the most impressive that have fallen, whether Katie Ledecky is just getting started, and how Michael Phelps got so good at scowling while his opponents danced shadow boxed in front of him.
Great gif.
It was incredible. And then back to the gym, or should I say the arena, where Team USA's gymnastics team is poised to run away with gold. We will marvel at Simone Biles and talk about why the Olympics are so good at creating interest around women's sports, or at least that's what I would argue
all right.
that they're good at creating. And then finally, a significant digit on Ichiro, the demigod of the base hit. Now that he has tallied 3,000 Major League Baseball hits, we will look back at his incredible career.
Chad, I believe he's the wizard of the base hit. According to Baseball Reference, at least that is his nickname.
I exalted
not
him to
believe that I have heard that.
I deified him when he should just be a mystical figure.
I think maybe a wizard is better than a demigod. I don't know.
That's
they can
take.
Cast spells.
Well,
we'll
put the numbers to it.
Yeah, we need a ranking of these types of figures.
Oh, of course.
All right. I feel like we've reached peak Hot Takedown before the show has even started. Let's turn to Alice McCann, who is live from Rio, our reporter, Hot Takedown's senior
reporter on the ground.
Olympics global correspondent reporter on the ground in the field. Allison, hello.
Hey, Chad.
So, Allison, this is your first Olympics. You've seen a few different events. What can you tell us about what's the mood like in Rio, as they say?
I think the mood is great. Spirits are high. Brazilians are doing very well. I think they have won some golds already, maybe judo. Their beach volleyball team is doing great. So, yeah, I would say overall the vibes are high in Brazil.
Allison, can you take us behind the scenes a little bit? I know one of my other good friends, that's classifying you as a good friend there, Allison, Kareth Berg is doing the sideline for the women's basketball team. And she's like, aside from getting stuck in traffic frequently when you're taking shuttles from location to location, like everything else is running swimmingly, to use a pun. What have you seen on the ground there? Is there anything going on? Of course, from the build up, we all thought it would be hectic down there.
Yeah, I don't have, like, a good, obviously, comparison factor. Like, I'm so overwhelmed just by the sheer craziness that is the Olympics. But then there's other people here, like Bonnie Ford at ESPN, who's been to, like, in 7 games and, like, all these crazy things. And so they have a much more sense of, like, this is working and this isn't working. But I, so far, yeah, everything's been pretty easy. It is, like, a really huge place to get around. So they have, like, shuttles within Olympic Park. So even though I'm like, oh, the game's at like 11:30, like I have to be like leaving at like 9 a.m. to like walk a half an hour and then like ride the shuttle a half an hour. Like it is, it's just hard to, yes, get places. You know, it's like going to like an NFL game. You know, it's like hectic in there. And then just like imagine there's like 30 NFL stadiums in one place.
So what are Bonnie, and I know TJ Quinn is down there too, who's also been to a number of Olympic games. Like, what are they saying is working? What's not working?
Well, I think the expectation was that everything was like going to be so dysfunctional.
Nothing was going to work?
Yeah, nothing is going to work. So the fact that there's just like a little bit of traffic and like the coffee runs out at the media center is like not a big deal. Like in Sochi, they were like, we like didn't have shower curtains like in where we were staying, and the buses would drive us like 3 hours in the wrong direction. So it sounded like there was actual really bad stuff. Here it's like, oh, you'll just wait for the shuttle for an extra like 30 minutes and then maybe be late or something. So just inconveniences as much as real issues.
So actual first world problems happening in the Olympics.
Yeah, I have heard too, and like obviously we have, you know, the media passes to quickly get into the, you know, back rooms of the events, but I've heard that the lines for security have been super long, which I can see the people like waiting to get in, and people have been missing the events that they have tickets for, which obviously would be super disappointing if you were trying to see someone. The security is really, really intense. They have like 2 rounds of, you know, basically like airport security that you have to go through.
So, Allison, you've been to live events for the first time, usually only watching at home. Are they different live than they are? So I think you went to a water polo match. Did it look different than it would have if when I watched it on NBC on whatever night that was?
Yeah, I think, at least for me, the water sports in particular are a lot better viewing in person because, like, you can see a lot closer like what's going on. Water polo is hard. I mean, the ball is obviously above water and there's like so much, like literally they're just like trying to drown each other underwater. That is still difficult to see, but yeah, it was cool to see like the court. I hadn't seen, or I guess the pool like field had these yellow, green and red like sections of the pool that like at like eye level for the players, so they can know when there's basically different zones in water polo. When if you get a foul, you keep playing in the green zone. And if it's in the yellow, it's a penalty shot. And if it's in the red zone, like an offensive player can't go in there. So things like that, I hadn't seen like a pool level view of water polo. So that was really cool. I also saw some team handball, which was awesome.
Love team handball.
That's a fun sport.
I really love that.
So fast.
Kate,
yeah,
I couldn't tell
it's
whether
so
that
fast.
Was...
No.
And I went to see Norway play Spain, and Norway has like the world's greatest goalkeeper. I think we'll have a piece coming next week that we're writing about the sports that it's most difficult to be a goalkeeper in, and handball is one of those. You know, they get scored on like 30 times in a game, but they also like make these wild Spider-Man saves where they're like flailing all their arms and legs.
This is the Norwegian women's team?
Yes, Norway's women's team. That was really cool, and there were not a ton of reporters at women's team handball. It's like their group play too, so it's just getting started. But there were people, you know, other media people at those events who are writing down shots and saves and, you know, like doing live data on just like a piece of paper during the game, which was really funny to see because in other things, like at basketball, they'll give you that, you know, at halftime and at the end of the game. But in some of these smaller sports, yeah, I've seen the actual reporters having to track stats.
Yeah, Allison, one of the things that I wanted to ask you was about that exact idea of kind of the stat experience of being there, whereas when we're on television, you know, when we're watching it on television on NBC, they're constantly inundating us with various, you know, graphics and numbers and things like that. And I was going to ask, is it sort of something that you have to do for yourself when you're on the ground there watching, or do they supply any of that on like video screens? And how much does it vary from sport to sport? And how much knowledge do you have to have of the sport to kind of even be able to do some of that hand jotting action?
So I've been to like 3 events of the, I think they're something like 200 odd events of the Olympics. So my wealth of knowledge about who's tracking what is small, but Yeah, I mean, I was in team handball, and I was like, I have no idea what's going on. I see this guy furiously marking every time something happens. So I think that there are people that you can't just show up and be expected to give in stats or be expect to know what's going on and things like that. Other sports, like I saw a soccer game on Saturday. I was away in Belo Horizonte. I saw the U.S. women play France, and that was really cool because I had they had like a little screen with like live possession stats and shots and goals and things like that. And I noticed too when I watch games live, it's a lot easier for me to sort of get distracted, and I'm like, oh, this is so great and fun to be here, and then I think I know what's going on, and then I look at the screen and like the exact opposite thing was going on. Like, I definitely thought France had all this possession and was like dominating the U.S. and then the U.S. like still had higher possession. So I was like, oh, this is a good reminder that sometimes what I'm seeing live is not what is actually happening.
All right, so Allison, what's on next on your docket before you left? We would let you go.
Oh man, I'm trying to get all over the place. I would like to get down to, so I'm staying near Olympic Park, so that has all of sort of the main venues, you know, for track and basketball and all that stuff. But down by the beaches is beach volleyball and some of the sailing and like windsurfing. And I've heard the like Rio, you know, Brazil vibes are much stronger there, as you can imagine, on the beach and stuff. So I would like to get over to those sports and, yeah, see just kind of as much of the kind of strange things that I'll probably never see again, maybe some archery and some rhythmic gymnastics. So I have a whole list, but we'll see what I can squeeze in.
Is trampolining still an Olympic sport? I love a good Olympics trampoline. That's what you should do. Send me some pics from trampolining, Allison.
Like, everything that's on Walt Hickey did this piece on, like, the worst Olympic sports, and, like, those are all the ones I want to see, because I'm like...
All right.
See,
well,
I will never see these sports anywhere else. Right. So
we'll leave you to go get your dressage. Is that what it's called? Right? The equestrian?
Right.
Dressage.
Yeah.
Allison McCann, thanks for calling in from Rio. I'm sure we'll talk to you again next week.
Thanks for having me.
When I covered high school sports, I had to keep my own football stats, which is really challenging. They had to be in the paper too. Like, I had to create the box score. I had to do rushing yards, passing yards, first downs.
Wow.
And
so you were the official kind of source of data.
Yeah.
That's
frightening.
That's frightening, and with such great power also. You're wielding power.
Yeah, I mean, obviously,
kids.
If there was a kid who I really liked or I knew their parents, I would just, like, take an extra, like, $100
and make
sure they got more rushing yards.
Sure, of course. As one does. You know, I think that explains how Peyton Hillis rushed for 1,000 yards that year and made the cover of Madden.
So, okay. Depending on when you're listening to this, 5 world records have fallen in the pool this Rio Olympics for swimmers. None more impressive to us good, patriotic, jingoistic Americans as Katie Ledecky's, who Ledecky shaved 1.91 seconds off her own world record on the way to the 400-meter gold in freestyle. She finished at 3 minutes, 56.46 seconds. Only 2 women have gone under 4 minutes, and Ledecky is one of them. She's seems to be like a force unlike any other within women's swimming that I can tell. Have you guys had a sort of a strong reaction when you watched her swim?
Well, first, I would say be careful, Chad. I was accused of being too jingoistic last week by someone on Twitter.
That's what I'm here for, to take all the Twitter flack.
Exactly. And yeah, you know, I think my favorite moment of the Olympics as a whole so far was when she was celebrating before anyone else had finished in the heat that she had, the record-breaking heat. That, to me, that was just like mind-blowing.
You guys, we're not going to talk about Lily King.
We can talk about Lily King.
Because...
But she didn't set a world record, but she did wag a finger.
The finger, the Mutombo.
Could a storyline be any sort of simpler and set up for everybody than like, hey, let's fight the Cold War again.
Right.
And have steroids
good
be the reason
bad.
Why we hate the Russians.
Steroids versus...
It was seriously black and white.
Here's what I will say about Lily King is she had the courage to stand by her conviction that steroid users should not be on Olympics teams, even when it came to other Americans, which I thought was really... great that like it wasn't something that was only about hating her opponent, but it was just sort of a principled stand overall.
And she talked this smack before numerous races, so she said she upped the ante. She didn't just afterwards, she was like, take that steroid user. She talked that smack beforehand,
right? As a 19-year-old, right? I think
as a 19-year-old,
yeah. That's incredible. So you don't want to talk about Katie Ledecky?
I do, but I just – I didn't think we could let this hot take down go and not talk about Lily King.
So, Kate,
But now we can get on
hold
to
– but real quick. Did you have a rival in college basketball when you were playing?
An individual rival or a team rival?
An individual.
Well, we know the team rival was UConn.
Yeah, right.
So, but I, what I'm saying is like – Between Lily King and Michael Phelps scowling at Chad Laclos, I think his name was, the South African swimmer, NBC packaged it as though it was a night for rivalries, you know, where these performances that the swimmers were having were motivated by the animus that they felt towards their rivals. And I'm wondering, as a high level athlete, whether or not that really did fuel you to perform better, or if it's just a bunch of narrative that we apply onto it.
I think in the game of basketball, it's harder. And also the black and white or rivalries that we see emit out of basketball tend to be developed over like years and 82 games of an NBA season that you can then develop a rival. Like in college basketball, you might play a certain team like one or two times. Mm-hmm. So the answer is no.
But these guys are swimming against one another at however many competitions. Big,
yeah, I mean, we pay attention for the Olympics, but right. I mean, they see these guys 20 times a year.
Right. All right. So let's talk about Ledecky, who is real good. She swims. She's more of a distance swimmer than she is a sprinter, and that's sort of if there's any limitation on her, it's that she's not fast enough in the 100 or 200, and she's competing in the 200, I believe, tonight to see if she can win. The thing is that she swims. If you break down, as our colleague Ben Morris does, if you break down the time that she takes to go 100 meters, you break it down for different lengths of an event, and so you look at the 800 or the 400 or the 200, let's say she swims the 1500, which is not at the Olympics, basically at the same speed per 100 meters as she does the 800. And that speed is faster than the average that most people swim the 800. Does that make sense? So most people spend 62 and change seconds. Most women spend 62 and change seconds per 100 meters when they swim the 800.
Right.
But Ledecky spends less than 62 seconds.
So basically,
1500. So even the endurance does not slow her down enough so that she could lap people. She could beat people that were swimming just the 800.
Right. So usually we see she might not have the kind of burst of speed she needs to be competitive in the 50. And she's competitive in the 100. I think she has like the second fastest time.
It's not like she's bad.
She's just not Ledecky-esque in the 100. But she keeps a pace up that's remarkable. And there's a great SL Price article out today that's trying to dive into why Katie Ledecky is so good. And some of it is about her physical stature. And by that, I mean SL Price is deconstructing how it's not about her physical stature and that she doesn't have the same imposing traits that you might have in Michael Phelps and all of the – Neil's like desperate to jump in here, so I'm going to let
you. I was going to say, first of all, dive in. I was just going to note the
pun. I'm doing all the puns
of it. Yeah, and that's what's really fascinating is sometimes we forget about the physical advantages that some of these people have unless they're like right in front of us with like a Michael Phelps and his ridiculous pterodactyl-like wingspan. And in swimming, I do feel like physical advantages kind of manifest themselves more obviously than in some other sports. But yeah, with Katie Ledecky, it's kind of more subtle what makes her so great.
Like SL Price, I really couldn't unpack why, one, looking at her stature and being like, when he was saying like a year ago, she like couldn't even run a 9-minute mile on the ground and couldn't do like two push-ups. Like she could walk into the room and you wouldn't think, oh, that's a swimmer right there. And then he couldn't even find like a emotional motivation that we often see among like amazing athletes. Like there's some darkness that's chasing them or some story that has propelled them to greatness. And with Katie Ledecky, he does try to unpack it.
I was just going to say, or they hate Russian dopers so much that it motivates them.
They shave a couple seconds off their time. But with her, it's like there's just this fierceness in the water that they can't necessarily show where it's born from.
Right. And what's interesting is that she came into the Olympics in London 2012 as a 15-year-old, totally unheralded, and won medals there. And then
just out of the blue.
Yeah. And then 2019, more puns, Neil. And then 2019, then 2016, as a 19-year-old, is breaking her own world records. But Ben Morris's analysis suggested that most swimmers who who are at their peak later than 19. So this is not even the peak of Ledecky that we're seeing, based especially on how she's beating her own world records, which is its own interesting thing. And this whole, like, so five world records were set in the pool so far. And actually, if you look at the statistical averages and things like that, Ledecky's actually isn't even the most impressive. And it's not the biggest jump from what the mean time is. That would be Adam Peaty's 100-meter backstroke, the Briton Adam Peaty. But what was interesting to me as I thought about this was it sort of reminded me, in my other life outside of Hot Takedown, I do a lot of science editing for 538. And we talk a lot about how science is sort of like an imperfect practice, but it's perfect because it innovates on itself and it stumbles towards the truth by building knowledge on top of itself further and further. And so eventually you sort of crawl and stumble your way towards a more refined version of what this ideal, empirical ideal is. And it's sort of this swimming sort of reminded me of that, where there's sort of like there's a target and they're chasing it, and then they improve upon it slowly but surely, maybe only by, you know, a few hundredths of a second. But that what we were watching in swimming was people still trying to approach like some human limit of what human accomplishment and athletics could be.
And this time around, it's almost like feels less incremental and more explosive. Like some of these records are kind of falling, not in this sort of like we're building and we're kind of gradually beating them by fractions of seconds.
Was it the Hungarian woman who had like a full 5 or 6 right. second best of the world record?
Yeah, and I don't know. And Kate, I think you wanted to talk about this a little bit more, about just the idea of is it something in swimming this year that is causing all of these records to sort of fall all at once, or are we just seeing like a great crop of swimmers happen to come together at the same time?
Yeah, I think when it comes to swimming, if you backpedal to 08 in Beijing and in 2012 in London, and basically over the last 40 years, and this is all built off of a Nate Silver article from 2012, swimming consistently, they shatter records at the Olympics. And his data was that, like, if you go to 2008 in Beijing, so there's 34. At that point, there was 34 events in swimming, and new world records were set in 25 of those events.
Now,
in
was
comparison,
that the year that they wore the weird equipment that was later banned?
The ban came in 2009. They wore it in Beijing.
And even if you compare that to track and field, where it's less frequent that we see world records being set. And Nate Silver was writing about how, this is a quote here, only 5 track and field world records were broken in 2008 games, and that's out of 47 events. So you've got 25 records broken out of 34 in swimming, and then only 5 out of 47. And Nate's trying to show how in track and field, it's consistently less likely to break a world record. And then the question becomes, why?
But what was interesting about watching the swimming is that there seemed to still be innovations that could be done about technique, maybe in a way that's different than running. And I think, you know, you saw Phelps during the team relay for freestyle stay under the water and for an extra like 2.5 seconds compared to everyone else, so he could avoid the wake on the water.
Yeah, he went under and was like in third place. And then when he emerged all those many seconds later, he was actually in first.
And Lochte has, I guess, improved his turn where he does this funny thing where he like does a back. He's on his back for part of it, and then he flips over or vice versa. And so there seems to be still room maybe for innovation in swimming that there isn't in track, is one theory.
And there's more room for innovation affecting performance in swimming to begin with, as compared to necessarily like a 100-meter sprinter. Like, they've always worn really tight clothing. but what I think what Nate points out in this article that to me is more eye-opening is that across the world, if you have the body type for a swimmer, the percentage of those athletes who are actually going to find a pool, and now we're talking about across the world, like whatever country you grew up in, if you grew up somewhere in Africa, if you could have been a great swimmer, are you necessarily going to like get time at the local pool? No, there's probably not even a local pool, as opposed to in running historically, like you don't need any equipment whatsoever. So all athletes who might have had a propensity toward running will engage in running. And that, so it's like swimming is sort of an exclusive sport to end up getting the type of resources you need to become good at swimming. Does that make sense now?
Yeah. So does that mean that there's more opportunities because you're sort of limited at the base level of the number of people who are allowed to kind of become
the participation
Olympic
rates, basically.
Yeah, swimmers, that if someone enters the pool so to speak, and kind of is predisposed to being great because of, you know, various traits, athletic, you know, qualities and size, that person would sort of have more of an opportunity to break through the existing barrier, whereas the barrier in running is pushed so far to the limit of human excellence that you can't just kind of like show up on the scene with a combination of great genes and great, you know, kind of your own hard work and break through, because somebody exactly like you and dozens of people exactly like you are already in track and field, whereas they may not already be in swimming. Is that kind
precisely
of the gist?
Yes, okay. That's a very eloquent way of.
Yeah, and I wonder. I don't know this stuff, but I wonder if there have been more. There's been more doping in track and field than there has been in swimming. In my imagination, there is. You know, but that's totally anecdotal. But and as because of that wall that you're talking about, Neil, where if everybody's the same, quote unquote, then and there isn't a lot of variation that you can do unless you're Usain Bolt and have this huge long stride. Then that means that doping is what you need to get you over the
edge. Yeah, that's kind of the Stephen Jay Gould theory of why there were no 400 hitters anymore in baseball, was this idea that, you know, back in Ted Williams' day, Ted Williams being the last person to hit 400, he was operating at like the max, you know, human baseball ability, and the pitchers that he was facing and his fellow hitters and everything kind of weren't, or a larger proportion of them weren't. But then now in 2016, or I suppose in the 90s when Gould wrote the story, you know, Tony Gwynn may have been operating also at the same exact level as Ted Williams, but the pitchers that he was facing were uniformly better, or the worst of the pitchers at least that he was facing were so much better than the worst that Ted Williams faced that it was harder for someone to kind of break through even at the same sort of absolute quality of human greatness athletically.
Because baseball had opened up and become more of a global game,
definitely.
And then you've got like the Negro League and this, you know, the end of segregation with baseball that pours in so much more talent.
And better nutrition and various other things that would cause, you know, just like the average human to be better athletically than they
what
were.
What we're basically saying is if you want to be great at a sport, hop in before no one else is doing
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
You know, like now is the time to do ultimate frisbee like, if you want to dominate.
And you could say that lacrosse is sort of somewhere along that as well, mm-hmm. because it's not totally a mainstream sport yet and there's a ton of college scholarships open. So it is a place where there's more opportunity than, say, in like a basketball.
Right. All right, let's leave it there. Let's skip Michael Phelps. Who you know, he's not. He's
we've
done
talked about him
about
enough.
Him.
23 medals, 19 golds, the ape
it's
index of an orangutan.
I thought you said we weren't talking about Michael Phelps. Now you're just talking about Michael Phelps.
That's true. Okay, let's move on to gymnastics. But first, a word from Hot Takedown sponsor. This week, Hot Takedown is sponsored by Stamps.com. These days, you can get practically everything on demand, like this podcast, for example. You can listen whenever you want, when it's convenient for you. So why are you still making time-consuming trips to the post office when you can get postage on demand with Stamps.com? Anything that you can do at the post office, you can now do right from your desk with Stamps.com. Buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package using your own computer and printer. And unlike the post office, Stamps.com never closes, so you can get postage whenever you need it 24/7. Right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use promo code ESPN to get this special offer. A 4-week trial plus a $110 bonus offer that includes postage and a digital scale. Do not wait. Go to Stamps.com, and before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage. Type in ESPN. That's Stamps.com, and be sure to enter the promo code ESPN. Okay, now back to the show. As we record this, the women's gymnastics team finals are happening. Allison, who you heard from earlier, is trying to sneak her way in to watch it in person. But as of this taping, the U.S. is comfortably ahead, which we expected given how good they were in qualifiers. In a sport that often is decided by tenths of points, the U.S. totally blew out the Chinese team, their rivals, the Chinese team, by 10 points in the qualifying rounds in order to make it to the finals, where they'll be basically competing back-to-back on the same events, 1-2, where they try and one-up one another, which is one of my favorite parts about gymnastics. So, like, the U.S. will go on – the Chinese will go on the vault, and the U.S. will. And then they aren't going across.
My quizzical look was more about a 10-point lead in gymnastics. Is that, like, a 60-point lead in – I need somebody to put this in context for me.
I'm not positive, but based on my understanding – it's like so big that it would take all the gymnasts falling or, you know, somehow okay. really messing up their prepared routines in order for something to go wrong. And so what's incredible when you look at the qualifying scores is that the top three gymnasts in the whole competition were all Americans. Only two of them can make it into the individual all-arounds because they put a cap on that. And so I think Gabby Douglas was the one left out. But Simone Biles, Lori Hernandez, and Allie Raisman were the highest-scoring female gymnasts from around the world in the all-around scores this season, not just at the Olympics. And then we had five of the top eight overall in the world. And so, Kate, how did we get to the place where U.S. women's gymnastics was this good? Is it the infrastructure that's beneath them?
I'm sure all of us remember 96, right, when it was Bella Caroli and then Carrie Strug. And then mm-hmm. there was the great SNL skit where Bella Caroli – do you guys remember this part? Mm-hmm. Carrie Strug. So the point is that there's a great article in Time about the infrastructure of U.S. gymnastics and the Carolis and the coaching. And I think there's a parallel to be made to, like, why the U.S. men's national soccer team often – underperforms at the highest competitions. And there's a lot of reasons, but sometimes one of them is, like, people talk about the coaching at the youth level and how a lot of the coaches who are charged with perhaps bringing up some of America's better athletes often don't have the kind of pedigree until you get to our U.S. soccer national team, where you have Klinsmann, who certainly has the pedigree. But coaching them on a day-to-day basis, you don't have that pedigree. Now you look in gymnastics and you've got the Carolis, who came over from Romania and certainly know the ins and outs of gymnastics from, like, the 60s. And they've set up this system where even if you're not coaching outside of Houston where their facility is, but you're coaching anywhere in the country, if you have an elite level gymnast, you're required to go spend time at that Houston gym and get a level of coaching that is at the highest elite level. And I think they've set up this system that doesn't allow any gymnast to not receive the pinnacle of coaching, at least for chunks of the year, which doesn't necessarily exist at some of these other sports that we are still struggling to reach that elite level.
It's interesting. That's a very pro-coach way of looking at the world, and I wonder if that's especially important when you have athletes as young as gymnasts are. I mean, I would argue that gymnast peaks come earlier than soccer players' peaks, for example, and so you really do need that hands-on coaching.
And gymnastics isn't like, hey, we just need your own, like, sort of like basketball or football, where you just your own athleticism certainly is key, but gymnastics is really structured about what judges are looking for and how you can maximize each point. Like, you need to hit a sweet spot with that, whereas if you have a great basketball player, you're like, go do your thing.
Yeah, it reminds me in some ways of, like, entering into, like, when, for example, when I first became a journalist in New York, I didn't know the rules of the game in a way, you know? Like, I may have sort of thought I understood how things worked, but you need a shepherd or a mentor or something to make you understand how things actually work, you know, within the structure and the elite world that you're now in, for example. And so, like, you need someone to explain that the judges are looking for deductions and that when you cross your feet, it's a 0.05 deduction versus when you leave your legs apart, which is 0.1. So if you can't keep your legs perfectly straight and your feet together, it's better to cross your feet than to keep it.
Or even, like, something that you would only know through, like, 40 years of experience, which is that sometimes judges will, like, have an intrinsic deduction that they're taking if, like, your facial expressions mm-hmm. aren't a kind of fluidity that's being expressed in your body. You would think, I would hope, that, like, that doesn't matter. What does it matter what Simone Biles' facial expression is? But somebody who's seen deductions and been like, why is that deduction happening, has probably compiled this idea that you do need to concern yourself with that.
Now, my question there also is, I would assume the participation rate of gymnastics is far lower than in soccer. So it's kind of, you know, something where you can actually take all of the elite athletes in a given sport in a country and send them to this camp and get the elite coaching. Whereas if you were to take every soccer player, you know,
totally.
you would have to have more coaches. So maybe it's kind of this perfect mix of, you know, the number of people and the amount of time it takes to kind of coach them up.
Yeah, it's totally a course analogy, because it'd be much more difficult to spend a week with Jurgen Klinsmann for every high-level soccer player.
But like you were saying, in something like soccer or basketball, where, you know, no pun intended, it's a goal-oriented sport, and it is just all about the ends justifying the means of scoring the particular ball into the basket or the goal, whereas like you guys were saying, in gymnastics, it's so much more about the technique and about the little subtle ins and outs that you actually do desperately need that level of coaching just to be able to kind of compete.
Right, because in basketball, it's like if you're doing things totally different than anybody ever did, like if your shot was just totally unorthodox and nobody else had ever been taught that way and it looked ridiculous, I can't even picture this type of shot, but it was going in and you were scoring 50 a game, it wouldn't matter. But if you're a gymnast and you're doing things that people don't like the way it looks, judges
that's
just
all
deduct.
That's literally what matters.
Literally
like, for
all
instance,
that matters.
Like Sean Marion, I think of him as having like a very kind of unconventional, some might say ugly jump shot, but he's, you know, he was hitting, you know, more than 50% of his field goals and you know, could shoot the three and make free throws. Didn't matter. Rick Barry shot underhand free throws and was derided for it until he set the all-time record for highest free throw percentage.
So for listeners who are interested in the sort of rating game of gymnastics, there's a new book out by Devorah Meyer. It's called The End of the Perfect 10 that I've read some reviews of, and it's sort of about how gymnastics has in some ways become more empirical, because before it was sort of a gut feel when someone got a perfect 10. There were some guidelines, but if there was a big moment, I think Mary Lou Retton is the famous mm-hmm. example of this, where I think it was the vault where she lands the vault and it's a perfect 10, and the announcer screaming at first, and then the judges do, and now there's a 16
ridiculously
plus point system
complex,
depending on how difficult it is.
System.
There's some formulas in the guidebook, and they're looking for deductions, and yet in some ways that's more of an empirical rubric than just saying 1 to 10, I would argue.
And does within that rubric, I'm assuming nowhere is like pressure of the moment, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas it seemed like it used to be. Like if you're on the balance beam and you need to nail something to win the gold, I think judges took that into account. Now right. It seems like, I'm sure as a human being you would take some of that into account, but if you've got all these other points to hit, it's harder to take that humanity into account.
Yeah, and it that's so interesting because it is sort of like this move that we see in a lot of areas of life of kind of, you know, making things more quote-unquote objective or empiricized. And, you know, like we were saying, for a sport like soccer, it's very easy to know who won because it's just about counting things. But in the case of these more subjective sports, I do find it fascinating how they go about trying to make something mm-hmm. that is inherently subjective more objective, and does that actually make it subjective in some ways? Because you're kind of you get almost like you know people talk about teaching to the test in academics. This would be sort of like what you would do now as a gymnastics coach, I would assume, is you have a copy of that rubric and you are sort of like trying to squeeze every tenth of a point out of it. But then does that take away something of the artistry and improvisation that used to emerge out of a sport that is purely based on gut feel, like you said?
So one more reading recommendation for listeners. If you are curious about why Simone Biles is so good, the New York Times has this sort of step-by-step rundown of her routine or her all-around routine. And there's one bit about her floor routine that said she's only 4'8", and she generates so much force in her initial run that she has more room after her tumbling to do a flourish at the end, like one more jump. And that one extra jump allows for her to basically rack up more points. So her innovation is to start her routine earlier, partly because she's smaller than a lot of other gymnasts. And that was so fascinating to me that there's, you know, like we talk about moneyballing, you know, various things. And this was its own version of that, where you're fitting in extra room for advancement just by innovating the way that you go about it.
Right. And so now it becomes almost, instead of an existing gymnast doing something differently, maybe it's more about the next generation of U.S. gymnast being of a certain body type mm-hmm. that would allow them to kind of do this thing that games the system.
Right. So can we talk for just a second about what, at least this is a personal feeling of mine, there's no empirical data for it, that it seems to me that the storylines coming out of the Olympics every 4 years are, if not even, then certainly more friendly to women and to female athletes than they are overall in sports. You have the women athlete in the U.S. We just talked about Katie Ledecky and the other swimmers. as sort of being stars in the making, right, for the U.S. team. And I feel like they're being discussed on ESPN and other sports media and with the U.S. women's gymnast team as well, of course. And it reminded me, Kate, of something you say a lot, which is that we need to find ways to build narrative and stories and sort of storylines that span careers for people in women's sports. And it seems to me like the Olympics do that better. And I'm curious if you have any thoughts about why, if you agree with that assertion.
I do agree with it, and it's because we've got the built-in stakes, and that is patriotism and then also an Olympic gold medal, which we've all, over the course of all human history, really, and now lately over the last century, ascribed a huge value to. And no other women's professional league has built up an inherent stake like that. Like, do we as a community think to ourselves, oh, the WPS champion holds a huge value. So we haven't built up any cultural stakes.
So I totally agree. What's interesting, though, is that these are once every 4 year athletes, essentially. I mean, some people watch gymnastics in the world championships, same for figure skating, same for swimming, whatever else. But it's odd to me that we are willing to engage in women, in the storylines of women's athletics every 4 years, but not on an ongoing basis. That seems...
Because there's no stakes on an ongoing basis. Like, seriously, I think if you're like, let's look at who any women's team, whether it's the women's basketball team right now, whether it's swimming, whether it's these gymnastics, like, we don't hold in high value world championships even for men's track and field. Really. I mean, it's not, those don't get great ratings. We don't end up talking about our runners. It really comes down to the fact that the stakes of an Olympic gold medal are, we all agree upon it.
Yeah, and I think also this is one of those cases where the men's sports and the women's sports get equal time, I think, on national television. And so you would be watching kind of a mix of both sports, and they're both treated the same with the same level of gravitas and kind of given the same respect, which I don't think always happens if we're actually even talking about women's sports at all, which is the bigger problem on, you know, major media outlets during non-Olympic events in the time between.
Okay, now let's move on to the closing, the coda of the show.
I love your vocabulary.
Our significant digit. Thank you, Kate. It's the nicest thing you said to me today.
It's true. I haven't said much nice to you, have I?
That was the subtext of my comment. Neil, you are bringing us our significant digit this week, a telling number from the world of sports. What do you have for us?
Yeah, so this was such a sport-heavy weekend. We had, you know, the Olympics starting up. We had A-Rod's retirement press conference.
It was
on
a promotion
Sunday
to the Yankees front office.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, he's going to be a valued member there. And then also in the afternoon, evening, we had Ichiro Suzuki get his 3,000th hit fittingly on a triple that he hit. And so he became the 30th 3,000 hit club member, but with Ichiro, it's all the more remarkable that he reached 3,000 hits because his career started so late relative to the other players that piled up the most hits in Major League history. He only came over from Japan at age 27 in 2001. He had been playing for the Oryx Blue Wave before that of the Japanese Pacific League. And so all season long, there's been kind of this debate over whether Ichiro's hits from Japan, you know, how much do they count?
And that's 1,200 something hits, right?
Yeah, it's a lot of hits. I don't have the exact number on me. But, you know, Pete Rose, of course, is the all-time hit leader in Major League Baseball. And he, what a surprise, thinks that the hits that Ichiro racked up in Japan shouldn't count at all, and that he's the all-time hit leader, and that it's nice that Ichiro has the 3,000 hits, but he's the all-time leader. And there are people at the other end of the spectrum that say, this is professional baseball. The hits that Ichiro got in Japan should count just as much as hits in Major League Baseball. And I think intuitively we kind of know that the answer is somewhere in between, that it is easier to, you know, get hits in Japanese baseball. It's a lower level of baseball than Major League Baseball here in the States. And you can just see that when you see the types of players that kind of go from the States and almost like wash out and then reemerge over there and become, you know, home run leaders and have great seasons there. What I haven't seen as much of is sort of trying to estimate exactly what that trade-off is, what that exchange rate is between a hit in Japan and a hit in Major League Baseball. So I tried to do that for the seasons in which Ichiro was...
He's a genius.
It's incredible. It's just like, you know... No one's done it, so I'm just going to
I'm going to do it. I'm
perhaps
doodle
someone
around.
Has done it. I haven't actually seen it. But and also, I should say, I used the site of someone named Clay Davenport. He's kind of an influential old-school sabermetrics guy that worked at Baseball Prospectus many years ago. But he had these things called translations that he used to kind of not just look at Japan, but also look at, you know, what's the difference between AAA and Major League Baseball, or AA and AAA, and try to translate between there, just to try to figure out, like, how good is this guy that at age 20 is tearing up the, you know, a league out in California, some minor league, when he gets called up to the majors. So anyway, I used his translations for 1992 through 2000. That was when Ichiro was playing. He started playing at age 20 in Japan, and I kind of looked at his translations and did a little bit of math of my own.
Can I interrupt you real quick, because I checked the number? It is, he had 1,278 hits in Japan. I think that will matter given what you're about to say.
Sure. If you kind of go through all the metrics and try to translate it to America, you would find that Ichiro, right now, if you make a schedule adjustment, and that's pretty important, I'll talk about that in a second, that you would get to 4,328 career hits for Ichiro.
How?
Right
more
now.
More hits than
more
he's actually
hits
had.
Than
right,
he's
more
had.
Hits than he actually had. So
the
way
that Japanese
works,
hits more valuable?
Well, so in Japan, he hit 352 roundabout those years. And if you translate that to the American League from 92 to 2000, you would find that that would kind of come out equivalent to hitting 316. So he would hit for a lower average.
But there are more games in the majors?
But the big thing that we don't really talk about with Ichiro, even if you take into account that Major League Baseball was on strike in 1994, so it was a shortened season, and then that carried over, you should
in any conversation I have.
Yes, all conversations. And it also carried over in to the beginning of the 95 season. That was shorter than the typical 162-game season, too. Even if you take that into account, Ichiro would have had about 16% more at-bats if he had played in the majors versus Japan, because in Japan, they only play about 130 to 135 games a season.
Think about all those hits that went unhit.
Hits that went unhit, exactly. And so Pete Rose's record is 4,256 hits. And Ichiro would have passed that a couple of seasons ago if he had been able to sort of have this translated track record built in, and I find it very fascinating because
Neil, they're going to play this significant digit recording when
Ichiro
gets into the
Hall of Fame.
I actually would vote to move this significant digit for the first time ever to the top of the show.
That's how,
because it's actually really enlightening. I had points to make that were sort of like about infield hits. Now they seem irrelevant compared to this data.
Well, thank you, Kate. But I mean, I do think that the infield hit rate is also interesting. We were kind of digging into that he, Carl Bialik, our colleague at 538.
Who put a quarter in Neil? We start talking about baseball and it's like...
That's kind of, you know, the way things are sometimes. But Ichiro picked up 5 bunt hits a year, which is really not that much because he was cranking out, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 180 to 200 hits a year at his peak, if not more. And 46% of his bunt attempts ended up being hits. Basically, he had a 460 batting average on these bunts. That normally, you know, there was a stretch where Carlos Pena was shifted on a great deal and they didn't have someone occupying third base. Literally no one played third base. And he was able to hit about 700 for over the course of a season on that until they kind of figured it out and it didn't work anymore. But with Ichiro, we're talking about like over the course of more than a decade, he's been able to kind of leg out these hits. And it's kind of a wonder how many hits he would have if he had played in the majors and he had been able to kind of, and you know, we wouldn't have to make these translations for him, but those stats had counted. And then also maybe he should have just bunted more. Like he could have gotten even more hits that way. But I find Ichiro endlessly fascinating.
Is this the book that's out on proposal for you?
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
That you're shopping?
Love it. What did we say it was at the top of the show? The book's topic was
Tebow and Ichiro. What Ichiro can teach Tebow.
Yeah.
That's how you sell that book.
Yes. Tebow.
Neil, you are hitting 700 on significant digits lately. That's what I have to say to you.
I thought
wow,
it was higher.
Done.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, I agree with Kate.
I thought it was more like 950. There was that one like back in November.
It was kind of a dud.
Yeah.
All right, that will do it for this week's show. Thanks to Kate Fagan. Kate,
thanks,
great to
Chad.
Have you back. Neil Payne.
Thanks, Chad.
Our podcast producer this week is not Joe Sykes. It's Jody Avrigan. Joe is on a beach somewhere, and so the Overlord has come to reclaim what was once his. Thanks to Jody for producing, and Galen Drukes also helped out with producing.
I, for one, welcome our new podcast, Overlord.
We got production assistance from Tony Chow and Jorge Estrada. It is 538 Sports intern Cetridge Crawford's last week. Cetridge, I have a little sad emoji face on my sheet here. Thanks for all the help, Cetridge.
Those prep docs aren't going to be the same.
I know. You can email us at podcasts@538.com to let us know what you think. That is a message to you, the listeners, not to Cetridge, though Cetridge is also welcome to email. You can find us on your favorite podcasting app or iTunes. Subscribe at itunes.com/538. Be sure to review and or rate the show while you're there. It helps others discover the program. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion with percussion by Kate taking off her headphones. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.